Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through. Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind. Georgia, Georgia, a song of you comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines.
Jimmy Carter, the naval officer turned peanut farmer, turned governor, turned president, turned Nobel Peace Prize winner, and longest-living former president, passed away in his hometown of Plains, Georgia, at his modest home on Woodland Drive, surrounded by his family. He was 100 years old. Carter served as the 39th president of the United States, beating Gerald Ford in the 1976 election. He and his wife Rosalynn returned to Plains after losing the election for a second term against Republican Ronald Reagan in 1980. His list of accomplishments post-presidency is voluminous. He's best known for founding the Carter Center, a nonprofit organization that prevents and resolves conflicts, enhances freedom and democracy, and improves health around the world. The author of 32 books, he made quite a few guest visits to this program, 7 in all. Carter was always polite, spoke of his love for NPR, and made one feel quite comfortable and cared for. Whether in Georgia or in hard-to-reach regions around the world, millions of people have benefited from Carter's commitment to making the world a better place. During a 2008 interview for his book, A Remarkable Mother, he said his mama Lillian laid the groundwork for those attributes.
Well, I think my mother, more than anybody I ever knew, exemplifies the finest aspects of American citizenship. You know, she was dynamic, aggressive. She would see something wrong in society, and she'd go all out to correct it, even though it meant criticism of herself. I grew up in a little community in South Georgia, one of the most conservative in the nation, where racial segregation was impressed on everyone except my mother, who completely ignored it. She spent my early life just dealing with the plight of very poverty-stricken African-American families who lived around us. We didn't have any white neighbors. These were folks that couldn't go to the hospital, and since she was a registered nurse, she cared for them, and she continued that all of her life. When she was 70 years old, she was in India in the Peace Corps, taking care, again, of the poorest people she knew who had leprosy and so forth. And like them, she was an untouchable in that she dealt with, you know, bodily fluids and things of that kind. So I think she was just one of the most dynamic and spirited, humorous people I ever knew, and I think it's good for Americans to know what a single human being can do.
A big fan of the Brooklyn Dodgers.
She lived and breathed the Brooklyn Dodgers. She knew about Jackie Robinson, who was from Cairo, Georgia, not too far from my home. So when he played his first major league game, she was there with my father, and she just adopted the Brooklyn Dodgers after that.
And enjoyed the baseball too, I assume.
Well, she and my father would go on an annual vacation in the early summer, and the only destination ever was a major league baseball city: Detroit, St. Louis, Cincinnati, obviously Boston, New York, Philadelphia. And they would spend 2 weeks in those cities just watching baseball games in the daytime. There weren't any night games then. And then going out on the town at night.
How political was she?
She was intensely political. In fact, when Lyndon Johnson ran for president in 1964, he was stigmatized in the South because of his voters' rights bill and civil rights movement. So he just gave Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi to Barry Goldwater. But Mother still was Lyndon Johnson's campaign manager in the county, Sumter County, Georgia. And she would park her Cadillac in front of the campaign headquarters every day, and at night she would go out, and a radio antenna would be tied in a knot and ugly messages all over her new Cadillac. And she would go home and grin, and we children would help her wash her car, and she would be back over there supporting the Democratic candidate the next day. So she was a deeply religious person and also a deeply committed Democrat.
And what was the reaction when you decided to run for political office and ultimately president of the United States?
Well, I came in and told her I was going to run for president. She said, president of what? And then later she told a news reporter she was glad I was going to run for president because maybe finally there would be a decent restaurant in Plains. So that was her overwhelming reaction. But she got out of the campaign for me 5 days a week. And she was an evocative person and a tremendous speaker. So I won very narrowly over Jerry Ford. And I would say that had my mother not been out campaigning, I would not have been president. So she was a highly committed and very effective political campaigner.
What do you think you learned from her? I mean, we obviously learned so much from our parents. What do you think you learned from her?
I learned her deep commitment to human rights. In fact, when I was elected to be governor of Georgia, I made my inaugural speech, and Mama was on the stage, of course, and I said, I've traveled the state as much as anyone ever has, and I say to you quite frankly that in Georgia, the time for racial discrimination is over. And that statement got me on the front cover of Time magazine a couple of weeks later. But then when I became president, she was also on the reviewing stand there, and I announced that human rights would be the foundation of our foreign policy. So I think in many ways she affected, you know, not only my personal attitude toward life, but also my political campaign commitments.
It certainly seems that she had a zest for life. You write in the book about how even when you were president and you would go back to Plains, she would want to go out and fish and talk to you on a boat instead of just sitting around having a conversation.
That's true. And while I was president quite often, I would have a press conference and the first question would be, Mr. President, how do you react to what your mama said last night on Johnny Carson's show? And I would say, look, I'm not responsible for what my mama said. One of the things, by the way, she said was on the first early Trivia Pursuit games, and it was, who said, when I look at my children, I wish I had remained a virgin? And the answer was Lillian Carter. So I had to put up with my mama's outspoken character, and she would just take over, you know, Johnny Carson or Walter Cronkite even show and make you feel like they were her guests instead of the other way around.
So how much of that was the entertainer in her, and how much do you think she really believed that?
I think the combination was perfect. She really believed it, and she used the entertainer in her to put her message across. There was nothing false about my mama. She was really frank and honest and just didn't care what anybody thought if they disagreed with her.
How would you celebrate Mother's Day?
Well, we always gather around the matriarch of the family. Right now, it's Rosalind. As long as Mother was alive, it was my mama. She insisted on that kind of deferential treatment. And so we'll remember my mother. We'll probably go out to her graveside and say a few words. And she was a powerful woman, and the impact she made on her children and grandchildren was very deep. In fact, one of our grandsons, her great-grandson, was in the Peace Corps like she was. He served in South Africa, and she served in southern India. So my mama's impact will still be strong on Mother's Day.
What do you think your wife learned from your mother?
I think to speak forcefully if she believed in something, not to ever back down, not to be too concerned about what people say in criticism, and that was Mother's wish for all of her family when on her 70th birthday. I quoted that in my book about Mama. She said she hoped for all of her children that they would do what they thought was right, what was exciting, challenging, unpredictable, adventurous, gratifying, and if you'll excuse the expression, not give a damn what anybody says about you.
Four decades after Ronald Reagan's landslide win in 1980, Jimmy Carter's one-term presidency is often labeled a failure. Indeed, many Americans view Carter as the only ex-president to have used the White House as a stepping stone to greater achievements. But according to Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Kai Bird and his book The Outlier, The Unfinished Presidency of Jimmy Carter, Carter's political odyssey is a rich and human story, marked by both formidable accomplishments and painful political adversity.
No, he wasn't just an outsider. He was that. He was from South Georgia, the first president elected from the Deep South, just about forever. But he was also an outlier, and that conveys to me the notion that he was self-consciously deciding to be different. And that's very much Jimmy Carter. He's an outlier on race as a Southern white man in from South Georgia. He just had a very liberal attitude about race growing up. He was an outlier in terms of his intelligence, his approach to politics, his religion, his born-again Christianity. And he's just a very self-contained, self-confident politician. And of course, you know, a very decent man. He has a moral center to him that we all recognize from his ex-presidency.
So do all of those things, they made up who he is, but they often spelled difficulty when it came to his governing.
Oh, exactly, yeah. You know, Hunter Thompson, the great gonzo journalist of the 1960s and 70s, once described Carter as the meanest politician he'd ever met. Now, that's not a word that you normally associate with Jimmy Carter, mean. But he had a really relentless determination to win, to succeed, not to fail. And he would do anything necessary to achieve power. But once he was in power, once he won the governorship in Georgia, he declared on the day he was inaugurated that the time for segregation in the South was over, shocking his audience and his constituency. And he did the same thing with when he won the White House. He, you know, came very improbably from sort of nowhere to win the Democratic nomination and the presidency. And then once he was in the White House, he refused to do anything that was politically expedient. He wanted always to do the right thing. And of course, this got him into trouble, and he ended up alienating quite a few of his liberal Democratic constituencies, and both alienating both people on the left and the right.
One of the points that you make in the book, however, is that while it can be forgotten, you make the case here in this volume that he actually got a lot done in his 4 years in office.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. It's forgotten. But in those 4 years in the late 70s, he undoubtedly passed more legislation than, you know, let's say Obama, or more legislation than Bill Clinton or the Bushes. You know, and it's a long list ranging from, well, he opened the door for boutique beer industry all over the country. Every city in America now has its own brand of beer. Well, Jimmy Carter opened the door for that. He made it possible for middle-class Americans to fly on airplanes for the first time by deregulating the airline industry. He passed the Alaska Land Act, tripling the size of the nation's protected wilderness areas. He deregulated natural gas that eventually led to energy independence. He mandated seatbelts and airbags that saved, you know, 9,000 American lives a year. And then on the foreign policy side of the equation, he, you know, passed the Panama Canal Treaty, normalized relations with China, passed immigration reform, and made human rights the center of American foreign policy. So it's a long list.
That long list was also highlighted by Carter's vice president, Walter Mondale, when he spoke to us in 2010 about his relationship with President Carter.
I think it may have been unique among president, vice presidential teams. We got along very well. I respected him. I think he respected me. We broke new ground, fundamental new ground, by bringing the vice president into the White House, executivize him, as we called it. And I worked with the president every day on every kind of issue, privy to the same information as the president, and was a general advisor, a troubleshooter for him. And for four solid years, that relationship worked through some very, very challenging times. And even to this day, we remain good friends. 2 weeks ago, Carter was out here for Habitat for Humanity, and we spent 2 days together nailing boards to this these homes around here. And we had a family dinner and so on. So I would say that it stood the test, and I'm deeply grateful that I was able to work with this extraordinary man.
He, of course, has just written a book, his White House Diary, which has been getting some interesting comments about it, of what he said about that time. But one of the things that comes clear in that book that seems to be overshadowed, because he really tries to correct the notion that it was a quote-unquote failed presidency.
Yes.
And puts forth just how much was accomplished.
Right.
Did you feel that as vice president during the time that you were accomplishing a great deal?
Yes, and in my book I write that. I think there's a very strong case that although the public perception at that time, after all, we were defeated for re-election, was one of diminished accomplishments. That if you look at the record, you look at what we had achieved, what we adopted, what we were able to do overseas with China, with the Panama Canal treaties, the breakthrough in the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, the emphasis on human rights. We were able to accomplish a lot here at home, the housing proposals, the education proposals. We passed the most sweeping energy proposals of all, and if they'd let them in place, we'd be not gotten rid of them under Reagan, we'd be in much better shape than we are now. All outside measurements of our legislative success ratio puts us right at the top, just under Lyndon Johnson. So I think we got a lot done. I wouldn't say that that was all very well known.
We'll continue our remembrance of President Jimmy Carter after this short break. At a critical moment in Jimmy Carter's presidency, he gave a speech that could have changed the country. Instead, it led to his downfall, and many historians feel ushered in the rise of a conservative movement in America. It was during a period of great upheaval in the United States. The energy crisis had resulted in mile-long gas lines, inciting suburban riots and violence. The country's morale was low, and Carter's ratings were even lower. The administration, racked by its own crises, was in constant turmoil and conflict. This coming after a giant diplomatic win. Historian Kai Bird.
He had a triumph of personal diplomacy at Camp David, where he brought Egypt and Israel to a peace treaty. And it's all due to Jimmy Carter's personal diplomacy, 13 days at Camp David, where he brought Anwar Sadat of Egypt and Menachem Begin of Israel to Camp David and literally sort of lobbied them personally to sign a peace treaty called the Camp David Accords. And this, you know, got Egypt off the battlefield for Israel. But he got little political credit for this. And though he won the Jewish vote in 1976 by 72%, he lost it in 1980. The Jewish Americans sort of regarded him with some suspicion because of the pressure he wanted to exert on Israel to stop building settlements in the West Bank, which of course turns out to be a very prescient position. Similarly, he alienated labor unions because he opposed Ted Kennedy's national health insurance bill because he thought it was too expensive. He tried to do the right thing and was trying to avoid anything, as I said, that smacked of political expediency. So he hated pork barrel projects and would veto pork barrel bills in Congress. This, of course, alienated some of his liberal congressmen who should have been on his side. But he dug his own hole politically in some ways.
The famous Malaise speech that was given in July of 1979, you point out in the book he never used that word, malaise.
Right. You know, if you read it today, that speech is just remarkable. It's a very unusual sermon, literally a sermon where he addresses the American people. This is in the midst of the energy crisis where there are long gas lines and energy crisis had been caused by the Iranian Revolution, and it was a temporary shortage of gasoline. But it was a shock to most Americans having to spend more than a dollar a gallon. And anyway, he, in the Malaise speech, he said, you know, you've got to understand that America is a country of limits. We can't just destroy the environment. He's talking about climate change and environmental concerns. But also in a spiritual sense, he warned people that, you know, you can't find happiness in simple material goods. You have to think about the community and not just the individual. He was speaking as a prophet and really speaking from the heart. And in retrospect, it was prescient and smart speech. Of course, he got, again, no political credit for it. The polls after that speech went up by 10 points, but a week later, he fired five of his cabinet secretaries, and this sort of was regarded as an indication of his political chaos inside the White House, and his poll numbers went down again.
And the speech was given just 10 days after the Camp David retreat. So you're coming off a pretty good news cycle at that point.
Right. It's an unusual moment in American history. The first time, really, that an American president had sort of subjected himself to a very introspective seminar over 10 days where he called religious leaders to Camp David, business leaders, labor union leaders, philosophers, book authors, to sit down and talk to him about the problems in the country and what they thought he was doing wrong. And here was Jimmy Carter dressed in jeans, sitting cross-legged on the carpet on the floor, taking notes with a yellow legal pad. It was seen as not very presidential, but, you know, this is Jimmy Carter. He's very down to earth in some respects, intelligent and willing to listen to criticism.
I want to talk to you right now about a fundamental threat to American democracy. I do not mean our political and civil liberties. They will endure. And I do not refer to the outward strength of America, a nation that is at peace tonight everywhere in the world, with unmatched economic power and military might. The threat is nearly invisible in ordinary ways. It is a crisis of confidence. It is a crisis that strikes at the very heart and soul and spirit of our national will. We can see this crisis in the growing doubt about the meaning of our own lives and in the loss of a unity of purpose for our nation. The erosion of our confidence in the future is threatening to destroy the social and the political fabric of America. The confidence that we have always had as a people is not simply some romantic dream or a proverb in a dusty book that we read just on the 4th of July. It is the idea which founded our nation and has guided our development as a people. Confidence in the future has supported everything else. Public institutions and private enterprise, our own families and the very Constitution of the United States. Confidence has defined our course and has served as a link between generations. We've always believed in something called progress. We've always had a faith that the days of our children would be better than our own. Our people are losing that faith, not only in government itself, but in the ability as citizens to serve as the ultimate rulers and shapers of our democracy. As a people, we know our past, and we are proud of it. Our progress has been part of a living history of America, even the world. We always believed that we were part of a great movement of humanity itself called democracy, involved in the search for freedom. And that belief has always strengthened us in our purpose. But just as we are losing our confidence in the future, we are also beginning to close the door on our past. In a nation that was proud of hard work, strong families, close-knit communities, and our faith in God, too many of us now tend to worship self-indulgence and consumption. Human identity is no longer defined by what one does, but by what one owns. But we've discovered that owning things and consuming things does not satisfy our longing for meaning. We've learned that piling up material goods cannot fill the emptiness of lives which have no confidence or purpose.
We'll continue our remembrance of President Jimmy Carter after this short break. Jimmy Carter, an obscure born-again governor whose brilliant 1976 campaign demolished the racist wing of the Democratic Party and took him from 0% to the presidency. As he entered the primary, he faced Jerry Brown of California, George Wallace of Alabama, Mo Udall of Arizona, Henry Jackson of Washington, and Frank Church of Idaho. Jonathan Alter is an award-winning historian, columnist, and documentary filmmaker. In his biography of Carter, His Very Best, Alter says even though Carter's name recognition was shaky, he entered the race at a very good time.
He ran for president starting in early 1975, right after he left the governorship. He essentially ran for a full year before the Democratic primaries began. And so his opponents were all these senators who had jobs in Washington, and they represented the status quo. And Carter, who was a brilliant campaigner, just doggedly did what he had done when he got elected governor of Georgia and just traveled incessantly, stayed at people's houses. And being, you know, unemployed really helped him because he just decided to essentially move to Iowa and New Hampshire. And that was at a time when the Iowa caucuses were not really significant yet. Carter, in some ways, put the Iowa caucuses on the map. And he also just benefited from a fatigue in the country with the scandals of Watergate and the lying of the Vietnam War. And so his moral message, and he basically promised he would not lie, and he didn't. He fulfilled that promise. It resonated in 1976. So even though he started out at 0% in the polls, and when the pundits started to kind of rank the various candidates, almost all of them Senate Democratic senators, and Carter wouldn't even make the list. But over time, almost by word of mouth, he started to do better and better. And then he finished second behind undecided in the Iowa caucuses. That launched him. Then he won New Hampshire. And he lost the Massachusetts primary, and it seemed as if maybe he had lost his luster. But then his big win in 1976 was in Florida, and he knocked out former Governor George Wallace. The kind of thing that I wanted to look at, Joe, was like the historic significance of certain developments that at the time were connected to the horse race. But in retrospect, that was the end of the racist wing of the Democratic Party, which had existed since the 1790s, you know, since the parties were first formed. And now, you know, you can say a lot of critical things about the Democrats, but they don't have any racists in their party. That cannot be said of the other major political party nowadays. You know, so this was a big deal because initially, you know, the party of Lincoln, the Republican Party, was the more integrationist party, and the Democrats were the segregationist party. And then with Carter's defeat of Wallace, that was over. And, you know, the transition had begun more than 10 years earlier with Lyndon Johnson, a Democrat, pushing through the Civil Rights Act and saying that, you know, he had lost the South for the Democrats for a long time, which turned out to be true. But Carter kind of completed that transformation.
You write that just after the election, Hamilton Jordan had predicted that Jimmy's problem in the White House will be that he's going to try to do everything at once. Sure enough, despite Furbish nearly round-the-clock work early on, energy wasn't the clear priority of his first year, but just one of dozens of initiatives. Carter introduced so many bills that Burt Lance thought, quote, it looked more like a smorgasbord than an agenda. That says a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think that contributed to some of his problems because he didn't sequence his bills in a politically skillful way. And some of his inexperience, which was very refreshing in a lot of ways, and he was an outsider, hampered him in Washington. But a lot of it was just that the Georgia Mafia, as they called it, you know, Hamilton Jordan and Jody Powell and the others around him from Georgia, became kind of insular, and they didn't mix well with the Georgetown establishment. And they had good reason to resent some of that establishment because there's a lot of anti-Southern bias. And the press corps, the post-Watergate press corps that had helped make him president, turned on him with a vengeance. As Jody Powell said, you know, he didn't only, not only did he not get a honeymoon, he didn't even get a one-night stand with the press. And, but throughout, he was doing things that were important, but politically inconvenient for Carter. And when he had a choice between doing what he thought was right and doing what he thought was political, in almost every case, there were a couple of exceptions, but in almost every case, he did what he thought was right. And in the kind of long reach of history, most of the time, he was right, especially on energy and the environment and things that relate to the long-term interests of the country, but on foreign policy as well.
Jimmy Carter was just 56 when he left the White House. It became clear quite early that he would be an active ex-president. With Rosalynn, he founded the Carter Center in Atlanta. It is on the same campus as his presidential library and museum, which opened in 1986 on Carter's 61st birthday. Since opening, the Carter Center and its observers have monitored more than 70 elections in dozens of countries in the Americas, Africa, and Asia. His personal diplomacy helped to defuse international crises and hotspots in North Korea to Haiti. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts in 2002. The Nobel Committee cited Carter, quote, for his decades of untiring effort to find peaceful solutions to international conflicts, to advance democracy and human rights, and to promote economic and social development. In 2014, President Carter made his last appearance on our show to talk about his book, A Call to Action. The book addressed one of the most serious, pervasive, and ignored violations of basic human rights, the ongoing discrimination and violence against women and girls.
Well, a lot of things have changed since way back then. And it's so good to be back home again. Not much left but the floor. Nothing lives here anymore except the memories of a coal miner's daughter.
You grow up in the Deep South, and the ravages of racial prejudice are around you. And so often there are very carefully selected scriptures to justify that discrimination. And you make that case that's almost exactly what's going on when we talk about this violence against women.
Well, that's true. You know, when we had a separate but equal in the South, we would have very senior Bible scholars come to our church just to tell us that God had ordained that white people be superior to black people. And they would quote Cain and Abel and stuff like that. But then, in addition, they would say, well, you know, slavery was actually permitted in the Bible. It says for slaves to honor your masters and that sort of thing. But we're going up further than that. So what happens nowadays is when men want to be ascendant or have the highest positions of authority in a church organization, then they very carefully select verses that can be picked out of the 36,000 or so that justify their excluding women from some very key roles in serving God. So I teach the Bible lessons. I teach Bible lessons every Sunday that I'm home, about 35 times a year in our little church. And when I get in a quandary like about that distortion, I go back and look at the words and actions of Jesus Christ, who never deviated in any way from equally treating women and men, and even exalting women far above what they ever had been honored, how they ever had been honored in previous decades or centuries.
You quote in the book Zena Anwar, founder of Sisters in Islam in Malaysia, if women are equal in the eyes of God, why are we not equal in the eyes of men? And that seems to be a question that you really try to grapple in the book.
Well, it is. You know, there's so many abuses throughout the world, and I'd say since most of the readers will be in the United States, particularly in the United States, we have a very serious abuse of women in this country, and it's basically unaddressed because the men kind of quietly take advantage of all the superior positions in authority and in pay scales and things of that kind. We pay women in this country about 23% less than we do men for the same work. And of the Fortune 500 companies, of those 500, only 21 of them have a woman executive officer, and she gets paid about 42%. Less than the average CEO in the Fortune 500. On the college campuses, it's one of the worst places in America for sexual assault. Only 4% of the rapes on college campuses are ever reported because the administrators of the university or the college, the presidents and deans and so forth, they don't want it to be revealed that sexual assault is taking place on their campus. So they counsel the girl, well, you got raped, But let's don't make a big issue of it. Let's don't prosecute the boy. And what happens is, according to the Justice Department, about half the rapes on all American university campuses are done by serial rapists who realize when they get on a college campus as a student that they can get away with it. And the same thing basically happens in the military. So this is what we have in our country is low pay and deprivation of jobs and sexual assault without punishment. Those kind of things ought to be corrected.
And when you look at that situation in this country, and then you look at it as a global issue, I guess the seeds of the problem are universal.
Well, they are. You know, almost all the great religions, all the ones that I know, Judaism and Christianity and Islam and Hinduism, Buddhism, they all have basic principles that are very highly admirable and inspirational. You know, peace and justice and equity treatment and compassion for those in need, love. So all of those are very wonderful things. But when religion is distorted, then that what you say is certainly true. It's very hard to find a verse, by the way, in the Quran that doesn't say that men and women are created equally. But of course, there are some very serious problems. I think you mentioned early genital cutting, mutilation. And that's not ordained by any religious text. It's not ordained by any government. It's not ordained by any husband. That's something that's perpetrated on little girls by their mothers because they were cut or mutilated when they were little girls, and they think it's the same. It's the thing they ought to do. So that's what happens. And in fact, 90% of all the women in Egypt have been cut, of all ages. And in some countries like Djibouti and Sudan and so forth, it goes up to around 95%. Of all the females in the country have had their genitals mutilated.
I have to say, in reading the book and hearing you write about that it just seems inconceivable that this is ever that this could be done, that it could be allowed, and it could be done at the record numbers that it's being done.
It's true. It is inconceivable, and I hope that this book will make an impact. In fact, it's been a kind of runaway bestseller. I think it's probably been the best immediate seller that I've ever written. I've written 28 books, and this has been one that seems to find a niche among people that want to protect their little girls. I have a lot of people come to the book lines with bringing their little daughters with them and say, I'm glad you wrote this book because I want to protect my daughter when they get to college or when they get in the military or when they get start looking for a job and so forth. So I think it's something that really preys on people's minds.
You have a chapter in the book about halfway through entitled Learning from Human Rights Heroes. What do you think we can learn from these heroes that ultimately can address this issue?
Well, you know, one of the groups of heroes that we deal with at the Carter Center are women heroes that have been coming to our center in Atlanta for the last 3 years to work on this particular project from which I derive the information that I put in the book. And they come from places like Malaysia, and they come from places like Egypt. And they are very heroic women who fight for the right of women to have full human rights guaranteed to them, the same as men. And if you look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which I kind of outlined in the front of the first chapter in the book, or first or second chapter, then you'll see that women are guaranteed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which almost all countries have adopted now, completely equal treatment, but we just don't give it to them.
You write toward the end of the book, you quote someone that you identify as one of your personal heroes, Ila Bhatt, saying, yeah. I have faith in women. In my experience, as I have seen within India and in other countries, women are the key to rebuilding a community. Why? Focus on women, and you will find an ally who wants a stable community. She wants roots for her family. You get a worker, a provider, a caretaker, an educator, a networker, a forger of bonds. I assume that's where your optimism lies.
Well, it is, and the Carter Center has had programs in 80 countries around the world dealing with health care and agriculture and so forth. And what we find, we're going to a little isolated village in the jungle or in the desert, that the women have in the past been excluded from any sort of leadership positions. But we turn to the women there because they are the natural ones to help to improve the sanitation in the house, to improve the diet in the house, and take care of the children and also take care of the husband. And so we teach the women how to be the leaders in bringing about a reformation in the health care system for that particular village. And the women have really blossomed forth, and they found that they can assume very quickly positions of real leadership, and even the men defer to them because the women are the ones that will learn about the rudiments of health care and apply it to the village. And also, a woman, when you train a woman, say, in a village, she's pretty well able to go from one house to another with impunity. Whereas if you train a man, you know, he may not be let inside a house unless a husband happens to be there or something like that. So we've found that women are the key to any sort of improvement in the general status of a community.
Well, I'm pressing on. Yes, I'm pressing on. But I'm pressing on to the higher calling of my Lord.
2015 was my year of Jimmy Carter. In the summer of 2015, Carter published his 25th book, A Full Life, Reflections at 90. He was speaking and signing books at the Free Library of Philadelphia. I made the road trip to my hometown to see a man I much admired. A few weeks later, he announced that he would undergo treatment for a cancer that had reached his brain. Given the nature of his diagnosis and his advanced age, he was expected to retire from public view. Instead, he held a press conference to discuss his diagnosis and treatment, saying, quote, "I have had a wonderful life. I'm ready for anything, and I'm looking forward to new adventure." On the Sunday following his press conference, he taught Sunday school at the Maranatha Baptist Church in Plains, Georgia, as he had nearly every week since leaving political office. On November 5th of that year, as his treatments continued, I flew to Atlanta. I rented a car and drove through rural central Georgia for just about 3 hours. I wanted to attend Sunday school. I sat in a pew in the filled church as the 39th President of the United States walked in. He walked in that room and greeted the crowd. And then he spoke of various interpretations of the Bible.
Morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Morning, everybody.
Good morning.
That's better. Good to see you all. Thank you. This Sunday we're going to be covering how the Bible was devised and how we get our modern-day versions of the Bible, and also the fact that we need translators of the Bible so that different people around the world can understand them, and also how we react to the Bible when it's read to us or when we read it ourselves, and how we think about the Bible.
He ended about an hour later, as quietly as he began, asking us to bow our heads.
Let's bow our heads for our closing prayer. Oh, Father, we're grateful this morning to see two brief passages from the Bible, while Luke wrote it and how it was used, the Old Testament part, by Philip to explain it to the eunuch from Ethiopia. But let's just take those two verses and apply them to our own individual lives, our personal relationship with our Creator, who gave us life and freedom to make a choice at every stage in our life of what we will do. And one of the choices we have to make in our life is, will we turn to God's Word as one element of our instruction on how to live, and one element of our inspiration to be a better person or not? And help us to decide to read God's Word in our own choice of interpretations of the Bible, but with a searching attitude in our minds, so that we can find the truth about ourselves in our relationship with our Creator, in our relationship with other human beings. We ask these things in your name. Amen.
I once But now